My first comment to all of you would be to recognize and thank Mr. Noyer for being here and the Fundación del Pino to have organized this this speech and or this dialogue, because it's a little bit unusual sometimes to participate in this type of debate. Normally there is a speech of someone appearing all of a sudden in Spain and giving us some lessons about what we need to do, how we need to understand topics, but this is not the case. I think Christian Noyer has been very close to many developments in the European Union, very close, and we will discover that in a while, of many ideas that we have shared between France and Spain, and has played a major role. He has been a very extremely helpful friend of Spain in many moments of our recent history, and so we are really very fortunate to have this dialogue with him. But my first question to Mr. Noyer will be, on a personal note, how do you feel being in Madrid?
Well, first, I'm really happy to be in Madrid. I love this city. It's one of the cities, I think, very vivid living in Europe, and coming from Paris, when I mean what I'm saying, and I've been living in other cities for a few years, and it includes Frankfurt. I really love being in Madrid. I'm very grateful to the foundation, the Pino, to have organized that and send me the invitation. Now, my feeling is also that we are probably at a key moment for Europe, for the European Union, for the area. Why? Because, well, first we have to face the likely exit of the United Kingdom. The first time that we have a country leaving the EU, it could be seen as a drawback for the European construction. But at the same moment, we have had unexpected, at least by the international observers and markets, developments in the political area, and that is true especially in France, because we have just elected in France a president who made a campaign very pro-European at a time where there was a general feeling that the Brexit was the start of the dismantling of the EU. We had fantastic articles. By the way, the same who wrote in 1998 that the euro will never come to light, and if it ever came to light, it would be a total disaster. But nevertheless, pro-European, very pro-European campaign, very pro-reformist campaign, at odds with all the populist, so-called populist movements we've seen in Europe. And this coming after after the elections in the Netherlands, I think we the ingredients are there, and hopefully will be totally there after the German elections to kick up a new start of the European Union. I think we need to do that. We need to seize the moment, and so that's for me an additional pleasure to have the opportunity to discuss that with Spanish friends.
Thank you, Vicente. But when we chose the title of our conference, explicitly we referred to refund, reform, or reinforce. And those terms, as you know very well, are not the same. You may be very pessimistic about what is happening in the European Union, so you would like to refund the whole thing, to restart again. You may be cautious about what is happening, and then you will have ideas to reform some elements of the European Union. Or you may be really pushing forward, thinking that this is probably a key moment, and then you would like to reinforce. In what group do you position yourself on those three ones?
Clearly, in the third group. I think we should not we should not consider that what we have accomplished so far is not good, is negligible, did not tackle the issues. I think we created something which is fantastic, which is a very original construction. We started with the economy. It was the the concept of the fathers, but the concept of the European fathers, Monet and others, was really start with the economy and then have closer links and at some point strengthen other parts of policies include the path towards more political union. So the whole concept, I think, was valid, but we should not stop in the middle, because stopping in the middle leaves problems open. But it has been a fantastic success. I mean, the first and foremost objective to make war impossible in Europe after what we had known before was completely reached. To make Europe a prosperous continent was, I think, achieved to a large extent. But then we had, during the last decades and years, probably the sentiment, and that we must admit it was exacerbated by the euro, simply because the euro gave the comfort of feeling that we did not need to continue making efforts, reforming, paying attention to the evolution of costs, etc. And I remember Jean-Claude Trichet used to go, when he was president of the ECB, used to go at the invitation of finance ministers to the Eurogroup every month. And every month he was absolutely loving graphs. So he was every month taking a graph and showing that the evolution of unit labor cost was such that we were going full speed into the wall. And no one was listening to him, because thought, well, what's the problem? Everything's well. And during 10 years, everything went well. And in the end, we know that we had a problem there. So we have to pay attention to real economy evolutions. We have to coordinate economic policies, and not only budget policies, not only fiscal policies, by the way. It's wider than that. And to do that, we need to continue to build things. But also what we have achieved, and I'll be short there, but what we have achieved after the crisis, to my view, is astonishing. I mean, we've been able to build a sizable fund in a few years. At the same time, we restructure the monitoring of policies, fiscal and normally structural and economic policies in general. We build a banking union, even if it is not totally finished. But we created so many things that normally take years and years in the course of 3-4 years. And that shows that when there is the willingness to move ahead, we're able to accomplish incredible things in a short time frame.
Yeah, but we built a fantastic project, but some key members want to leave. And that takes us to the Brexit, and then how do you fit Brexit in all that?
Well, in a way, I'm trying to distance myself a little bit. I mean, there are positives and negatives. I'll start with the negatives. First time since 1954, when we started everything and we had the steel community at the time, that we have a member wanting to leave or deciding to leave the union. So in a way, it's terrible, because we should ask ourselves the question, what went wrong? And many observers considered that it was the beginning of the dismantling of the EU. But we should try to see the positives. And to me, the positives are of two kinds. I mean, I have many good English friends, and I do regret that they leave. But this being said, there were two problems with the UK. One was that they had decided not to adhere to the euro, and they had a permanent exception clause. What that meant was that there was structurally a difference, even in the long term, between the EU and the euro area. And many problems that we cannot tackle, to me, are due to this difference between the two concepts. when we are told you cannot have a monetary policy if you don't have a fiscal policy, so you should do more with the European budget. Okay, but the European budget is the EU budget. And for those not members of the euro, and who will never be members of the euro, it's a problem. Now the situation is clear with the UK exiting. We have the two concepts in the long term should be identical, because except with the exception of Denmark, but which is in fact so much linked to the monetary union that is not much difference, all countries are either members of the EMU or committed to become members of the EMU when they meet the criteria. Some of them are playing around put that into the future because there are political problems at home, but in principle, it's the same. It should be the same concept at some point in the future. So that's the first issue that is solved. The second positive I see is that the British never totally adhered to the concept of a union moving towards some form of political union, whether it will be in the long term a true federation or a confederation or a new concept, even a bit weaker, but the idea that we will have more than simply a single market and an economic playground is shared by many countries, was not shared by the UK, or only by a minority in the United Kingdom, even in the camp of the pro-Europeans. So that will clarify and hopefully facilitate the acceleration of the construction of the European Union.
But let's stay for a while in the Brexit. I imagine that in the coming years, the European Union has to do two things then. One is to establish a new path for the current members, and at the same time negotiate something strange with one of the partners who is leaving. So that divorce should mean something in terms of policies or adequation of that member to a new reality. Are there costs or elements there that should concern us and that even can have a very negative effect on us?
Well, for me, of course, there will be complications of several kinds. First complication is that at a time where we should, when as I said, I think there is an opportunity to accelerate, to take new initiatives, to make strong progress. I think there is an openness in several countries. It's certainly the case in Spain. I think it's going to be the case clearly in France, and I expect it is the case in Germany. We always have the feeling that the Germans are reluctant for some kind of progress. On the other hand, they always took the view that monetary union and sharing economic and finance could only work in the long term if there was more political unity. So I think if we take them at their word and we tell them, okay, let's build new things together, we can hope to have a positive reaction. So we should do that. At the same time, we will spend millions of pounds of politicians and political responsibles and civil servants simply discussing the Brexit, because there are so many things to negotiate. So that's a complication, for sure. There are also other problems, and I see myself personally more problems and more risks in the trade area than in the financial area. In the trade area, we are very integrated. We have value chains which are largely integrated in different domains. It's well known for aeronautics, but it's true also for pharmaceuticals, chemistry, electronics, and in some sectors of the processed food industry. To take my favorite example, today the fishermen of Spain and the Spanish and French fishermen have access to the British waters. They go there, they fish, they take fish, and they go to British harbors, they disembark the fish goes to plants that process and pack it, and then the fish is re-exported, for instance, to Germany. So if tomorrow the fishermen of our two countries lose access to the British waters, then they have a problem. They lose their jobs, but the workers in the food industry in the UK lose their jobs too, and the customers in Germany don't get the fish. So we clearly see that we need to agree to maintain that at least in a transition period. Otherwise, there will be disruptions. And then that is a very tiny example, but there are millions of examples like that. So we need to find a way to continue that. And it's complicated, because the single market means basically single regulation and single judiciary system. So if you want to have a free trade agreement, which is something probably everybody wants, free trade agreement, to me it takes 5 minutes to agree on putting custom duties to zero. That's easy, you have people of goodwill, common interests, no issue. Okay. But then you've done one part out of a million of problems solved, because then the real issues start. That is, how can you accept that products come freely into your market without any control if the norms and regulations can diverge? For instance, today the pharmaceutical regulations are the same in the UK. Nobody knows what they will be in 10 years or 20 years from now, and the same for the EU. Can we agree in a free trade agreement that even in 20 years the pharmaceuticals can come, whatever is the regulation is the UK? No. So we need a process to follow the divergence of regulations, if that happens, and to define what are the products that can continue to enter freely without control. How do we ensure that without controls there is no import of products that would not be on the list of things that are admitted freely? So it's so complicated, because you have to do that in all domains, all the types of products, that well, with Canada, which was to me a relatively easy problem, it took 7 years to negotiate. With Switzerland, which is totally inside the European Union and the euro area, it took 10 years and 100 or 120 agreements, sector by sector. So it's a huge thing. So it probably will take, even if we start with the same regulation, the problem is what happens in the future. So it probably would take, I don't know, I might be wrong, but it might take 5 years, 7 years. On top of it, we have to renegotiate with the WTO, all the WTO members. We have to renegotiate with all the countries, not only Canada and Switzerland, but Korea and a few others, with which we have bilateral agreements between the EU and that country. We have another of my favorite examples. We have an agreement with Korea. In this agreement with Korea, one of 1,000 different topics is there is a quota of beef, Korean beef imported in the EU. 80% of the quota goes to the UK. Now, what do we do? Do we share that quota?
They eat a lot of beef.
It's a lot of beef, but if they say okay, we continue to take 80%, then we can solve the problem. If they say no, we want to have a separate agreement, we shall see. So we need to renegotiate two agreements with Korea, and that cannot be done in a few days. So all this to show that there are huge problems involved. It will take time, so we need to find an interim agreement. And the interim agreement is more or less probably a sort of customs union that would be accepted by the WTO and probably means that the UK would continue to follow the EU rules for a number of years. And I'm not even talking of the European Court of Justice, so which is normally what should happen with a customs union. So you see that it's very delicate and it's of huge importance. For me, it's much simpler in the financial sector.
Okay, we'll touch on that. But that means, for example, that you think that in Spain there are a lot of sensibility put on the idea of us losing British tourists or our vegetables and fruits not going to the UK market and things like that. You think that there will be some sort of arrangement of a long transitional period that will be found, which is going to be complicated anyway, which might at least solve partially the problem, and it will take us, I don't know where, because at the end, as many journalists say, Brexit is Brexit, you know?
Yes, I have difficulties to, I think we of course we will need to find out the appropriate agreements, I hope at the level of the European Union, when there are a lot of citizens of each country living in the other one. And it's clear for me that, I mean, I do not see how the British tourists, because of Brexit, who stop going to Spain or to France, the Riviera, the Southwest, or Brittany, because they are not going to, I mean, not all of them are going to change their destination and go north. They like south. They're not all going to go to North Africa, especially at the moment. And already some of them go far abroad, but I don't think they will change basically their habits. And I do not see the big change that it may mean. But we have to make sure that practical problems are solved. For instance, today the access to the health system in each country is easy, is automatic, is well covered. So we have to make sure that it continues. But I don't consider that it's a huge problem. But it's part of the issues to make sure that we can handle. That's true.
Okay, Mr. Let's switch a little bit now to France, because probably for most of the people that are here, maybe for everyone, what has happened in France is like a miracle. We live from Spain. The first impression was that it was much more important what was happening in France for us than for you. That was the initial impression, is that because if something wrong happens in France, we are dead. We return to the idea of the Pyrenees and the alternative look terrible. And then all of a sudden, this young politician appears and is going to gain with a vast majority and is going to be probably the most pro-European parliament ever in Europe. And is this a miracle, or are we dreaming, or?
No, I don't think you are dreaming. Well, of course, there was a success, I mean, there was a combination of the talent of the person and of the...
But don't tell me you expect that 1 year ago.
No, I didn't expect that 1 year ago, but 1 year ago I thought that the concept had the chance to run. I mean, there was another man in the who had more or less the same kind of idea, who was Alain Juppé on the right wing. And the concept was the following, that Macron used beautifully, superbly. The idea was we have been unable to do to make a series of strong reforms in an organized way. We always did small reforms, bit by bit, and sometimes we were reversing that or going in the wrong directions. Why? Because of this fight between the right wing and the left wing, and even the moderate on the right or on the left felt obliged to fight the reforms proposed by the other side. And given the tendency in my country, I mean, to be, we remain revolutionaries since 1789, you know, so sometimes we like to demonstrate. And so it has a happened, it has appeared to be impossible to make strong reforms. What the Dutch have been able to do, for instance, by agreeing on some basic things. The right, the different parties agreed at certain point on certain reforms that would not be disputed by any of the parties, and then they can have differences on other things, but there is a basis of for a good governance of the economy.
We are also very bad on that.
but the idea was, let's try to have a sort of centrist majority with people coming from the right and from the left. Now, it's exactly what Macron is about to achieve, and that means that he will be able to make reforms that will be supported by politicians from the moderate right, politicians from the moderate left, and this is probably something that will appear much more stable in the future. So I think that's the basis of this miracle, plus the talent of a man who was young and was able to revive some dreams, and you need dreams to be enthusiastic about votes. There was a fatigue with the old political parties and responsibles who had been there for many years, and I mean coming with a new generation, pushing a new generation with the two sensitivities to work together to achieve reforms that was strongly approved by the general public.
But he has been voted majority with two elements. One is Europe.
Yes.
You even say Europe protect
us. It's fantastic. You're right.
And then reforms.
Yeah. He was elected being strongly pro-European and strongly pro-reforms. So it's something that we could hardly dream of such a victory. With I thought personally that we would go in that direction, but such a strong backing is wonderful.
Fantastic, and I'm sure you have had some insight on what could be the first steps taken by the government in the coming months. What is your perception about what will be the approach?
No. The concept is relatively clear and well explained. The idea is, during the first 3 months after the parliamentary elections, that will be finished next Sunday, first 3 months or 4 months, we make the labor market reforms, essentially. And 3 months thereafter, that is the fall until December, because it's the time where we design the budget policy for next year and the social security budget for next year, that will be the time to change and to reform as far as possible the tax regime to make it more business friendly. So normally in 6 months or so, 6-7 months, the bulk of reforms will be done. Since it should end just after the German elections, my view is that in next December, having finished that, we can now, with other countries willing to push ahead, propose to Germany, which will have finished its electoral cycle, to move ahead and try to design new policies for Europe. So, having regained the credibility that Spain regained, I think, when it made the strong reforms of the labor market and is rewarded now with a remarkable rate of growth, and we clearly see that the growth potential in Spain has been changed by the reforms already done. Probably other things can be designed also, like in all countries, and that includes Germany, by the way. But still, we should have a chance by the end of the year to kick up a new start.
Which is fantastic, because when we started 2017, the there were gloomy days, and everybody was really pessimistic on that. But let's turn back to other European issues, and I want to touch a little bit on monetary and banking union policies and also institutions. The sentiment that most of the people, maybe without knowing all the details, is that we are far away from a European single market. We are far away even from a European, really European banking union. But you were commenting at the beginning that, no, that's not true. We have done a fantastic job in only a few years and the worst years of the crisis. Can we develop a little bit what has been those main elements that are in place that could probably help us to create that complete European banking union?
Well, first, I think the first few years of the euro, the first 10 years of the euro, were extremely worked extremely well. We created a unified monetary area. We had a unified money market, and things went extremely well. I think there were two drawbacks. First, that we did not look at the divergence of economic policies, cost structures, etc. So therefore, the second episode of the crisis. But maybe more paradoxically, the combination of the single market rules and of the euro has led the banks in particular, but not only the banks, also the asset managers and the insurance companies to a certain extent, but mostly the banks or the investment banks, to consider that, after all, having only a single, only one currency meant that you didn't need to have a trading room in Frankfurt, another one in Paris, another one in Madrid, another one in Milano, etc., etc. So why not have just one? And since you had the single market, you could have that in London. So we lost what we had 15, 20 years ago, that with a hyper concentration in London, meaning that we were the only monetary area without a financial place, without a clear, without many of the aspects of that you normally find in a financial place. So we've been able to tackle with the primes of the crisis, but we still had that issue. And we saw, for instance, in 2011, that the decisions taken by the regulator in London or the managers of the infrastructures in London were not taking into account problems of financial stability in the EU area. In short, to make a long story short, it was not their mandate or their preoccupation to know whether the EU area would explode. At the peak of the crisis, their problem was to safeguard the safety of the city of London. We cannot live with that in the long term, and now the Brexit will clarify that. We need to have the major financial activities, at least the critical mass of those financial activities, under the regulation of the EU, under the supervision of the European agencies and of the ECB, and be able to take into account all aspects of our financial stability when there are decisions taken by authorities. So from that standpoint, I think the Brexit has also an advantage. It will bring back, it's not a question of only picking jobs from London and putting them somewhere else, but it's a question really of the balance of responsibilities and the capacity to maintain financial stability fully, especially in the EU area. So I think that should happen. It should happen simply because it's not the Europeans that will exclude the UK from the single market. The single market is basically a single regulation, a single judiciary system. And on top of that, the four freedoms and a good contribution to common costs, and that is contribution to the budget. But the basis is really regulation and judicial system. When you decide to get out, you decide to get out of the single market. It's as simple as that. And therefore, and all the big international banks and insurance companies have started to understand that, the banks are well advanced. They will move what is necessary to serve the clients in the EU, and they will move the what is necessary to ensure the risk control and the compliance of those systems, the trading related to those activities. They will move a sizable part of the management of funds, because that's the logic of the EU regulation, and they will move also the provision of insurance to a large extent to the European Union. So we will see a sizable change in the way financial activities are organized, and I think London will not disappear. It will remain a very important financial place, a global financial place, but we will regain, I think, the more capacity to fund the economy, to provide the appropriate services, to ensure financial stability. So I think I'm rather positive on what will happen.
Okay. I want to touch on some of the critical things that have happened in the banking system in Spain in the last 2 weeks. But before that, if I understand correctly, there is an issue about the European monetary market, the money market in Europe, that has been lost in the last years and has not been recovered. And also there may be an issue about how the ECB was conceived and has been working. Are those elements that should be improved or changed or
Yes, there are things that, I mean, when I said, for instance, we've been able to build a banking union very quickly, that is partly true. We've built the first pillar, the supervision. It starts to work relatively well. To my personal preference, it's a bit too centralized, and the ECB should be rather like the Fed in Washington in monitoring, giving instruction to all the local supervisors, but whatever. The first pillar is starting to work relatively well. The second pillar, the resolution, apparently can work when it's allowed to work. And Spain gave a fantastic example, I believe. We need the third pillar, which is really in the making, but at a very early stage, with a long, long-term view, that is the deposit insurance system. This scheme we need to develop more rapidly. So this is one of the things we should develop quickly and reassure everybody that it's not at all the objective of transferring money from Germany to Greece. That's not the issue. But we need to have a system that really gives confidence to all depositors and therefore avoids increasing tensions in periods of when there is an accident or in periods where the country is under pressure. There are other things that we lost, as you mentioned. Personally, I'm shocked that during the first 10 years, we had the totally unified money market. Then we had the crisis. And then the regulators and the deposit insurance scheme started to say, you cannot use the deposits made in country X to transfer the liquidity in country Y, which means that the money market does not work. If you cannot, so the bank started, and that's, it's more than simply the difficulty of moving liquidity from Germany to Italy, for instance. It has proved impossible at some point to move liquidity from Belgium to France, which is, I mean, quite amazing. And the banks who wanted to do that and could not had to move the assets the other way, which solved the problem. But still, it's unbelievable that we cannot have a unified money market when we have a unified a monetary union and a single monetary area, and we're supposed to have a banking union. Doesn't make sense. I think the ECB should do its job and ensure the reunification of the money market as soon as possible. It's really a matter of urgency, and all those sort of things have to be fixed quickly.
Okay. Let me touch, as I was telling you, on one topic that has been very important in the last days, which has been the resolution of Banco Popular. And I want to have your views about what happened. But at the same time, let me throw you three comments that are very popular comments and that entail some criticism. The first thing is that probably we were not part of the European Union, banking union, this would have never happened. We don't tend to kill banks that way. So we have had other problems in the past, and there's always a way to find an excuse to leave the bank or protect the bank, or and that has happened because there is a European Union. That's my first comment. The second comment is, we resolve banks. Italians put public money on the banks and save the banks. That's the second tough comment. The third comment could be, Banco Popular has always been a fantastic bank, recognized by being one of the most efficient banks in Spain. And even in the last stress test, they proved to be with a fantastic level of solvency. So the rules we have been applying do not work. Only some weeks ago, it was solvent. All of a sudden, it has been resolved. This is part of popular thinking, and sometimes political thinking also in Spain. What are your comments? It's a difficult one. I'm sorry for that.
No. It's a difficult question, but it's a very interesting question. And of course, I do not know all the details of the situation of the bank, the how the operation was exactly managed. For instance, why is it exactly 100% of the equity that was needed, and neither 99% nor 101%? I don't know. Equity plus the quasi owned funds. But this being said, for instance, the COCOs, etc. But this being said, I think, yes, probably there was such a habit to support the banks, but there was a reaction worldwide. We do not want to see public money, the taxpayers' money involved in saving the banks anymore. So we needed to have a system. The system cannot be you let the bank in bankruptcy, and then the depositors lose their money, or you have only as a safety net the deposit guarantee scheme, but all the other deposits are lost. There must be a way to reorganize the bank and save all deposits if possible, and even the normal lending by simply restructuring the bank, selling the bank, maybe dividing the bank, but it should be feasible. Or in some cases, it could restart if it's a limited problem. So I think it's a success of this policy. Now, why wasn't it imposed in Italy? I think it should have been imposed in Italy. A problem they had was that there was mis-selling of equity as if it had been secured bonds or deposits to small depositors, small clients, and they had the fear of imposing something that would not be, that would have been the knowledgeable shareholders, as we can expect in a bank, but ordinary depositors. But this being said, it should not be an excuse. First, I think those who did the mis-selling should have problems. We should not let them go, because this is unacceptable in the long term. So some reaction should be done. I don't know if this is a criminal investigation or simply a civil litigation, but it should be looked after. Second, I don't think that MP Monte dei Paschi di Siena should be allowed to continue as before. It has to be restructured, and public money is step one. But there should be a step two, where you restructure the banks, you cut, or you sell it, so you resell it to an investor, to another bank, or you cut it in by half or by a third, and you sell it to different banks. But it should not be allowed to continue like that. Otherwise, it's the principle. And it should be an exception. That is, if there are other problems in Italy, I have no idea whether there will be, but they should be treated with a normal resolution scheme, and that should be made clear, absolutely clear, to the Italian authorities. Now, your last question
was the relation between the stress test passed by Banco Popular and...
The problem that... maybe not many people understand is that the stress tests are a way to see what happens to a bank in case of a shock or a certain degradation. So if you take the situation of the bank as it is assessed at a certain moment, but I come back on that, and then you say, okay, suppose we go into a recession. Suppose there is a change in the exchange rate of 20%. Suppose we have this or that. What happens? And is the bank able to resist? If there is a recession, the amount of non-performing loans increases. Is there enough buffers and capital and provisions to be able to handle that? And we see it's a test of resistance to a certain evolution. But if the situation at the beginning is not what is published, what is announced, if there are more problem loans that shown to analysts, then the stress test is not a proof that you will never fail. It can only say what it can say. So, was there an issue of assessment of the portfolios, or were there mistakes? Probably there were mistakes of management done, and the situation in the bank can move very quickly. We should never forget that the quality of the balance sheet protect fully against the bank run. If the confidence is lost because of bad communication or mistakes in communications, let's say, managerial mistakes, if there start to be a move of depositors outside and the loss of liquidity, then it can go very quickly, and you can fail because you lose your liquidity, and you try to counter the liquidity, you start to sell assets at a price which is not the optimal price, maybe, and then very quickly the quality of your balance sheet is moving down, and you can lose part or all your own funds very rapidly. So all this has to be taken into account, and it shows, by the way, that having put also an emphasis on on the liquidity rules for banks, maybe not enough again, but we have to look after that and draw lessons. But that was an important part of the reforms of the banking regulations.
Do you think, and that would be my last question on this topic, do you think that the perception about the Spanish banking system or the Spanish banks is going to suffer internationally because of this element? Or you think, on the contrary, that this is something that could happen and it's a proof that the system has worked?
I don't think so. I think it proves the system has worked. And the capacity of the system, I mean, to make a resolution in a couple of days and find a buyer and start again and accept the shareholders and holders of Coco bonds, but otherwise nobody lost, whether they are depositors or bondholders clients in general, and operations continue as before in a new framework, that is perceived outside as extremely positive. And I think very rapidly that will be rather an asset and a demonstration that the system is resilient, at least that's how I feel it.
Okay, I want to give the floor to people and ask you a question, but let me ask you probably the last one, referring to the steps to be covered from now on. And I would like to have your opinion on three topics. One, if it's possible and when and how to create a unified guaranteed deposit scheme in the European Union. Second, so many comments have been made on the capacity of the Union to have a sort of economic minister or treasury or some sort of Eurobonds being issued. How and when this can be tackled and approved or launched or work out. And finally, what are the last steps for the European Union, banking union, that can be taken in the coming maybe 1, 2, 3 years?
Well, I think the deposit guarantee scheme is something that has been clearly foreseen, designed. Simply, the decision was to build it in so many years with so many precautions, so many steps, because there was the fear in countries which had, let's say things clearly, the countries of the north of Europe, Germany, but also the Netherlands. I mean, in the Netherlands, the taxpayer paid a lot to save the banks and to repair the damage done in the first episode of the crisis. And they were afraid to have to pay a second time for the south countries. So as long as we could not prove we had fixed the problems, mostly, it was difficult to convince. In from that standpoint, by the way, what is happening now, in particular the story of Banco Popular, shows that, I mean, really the deposit guarantee scheme is the last resort, but normally if the supervision is well done, if the banks have been restructured, if there is enough capital everywhere, the likelihood that you have to tap those systems is extremely small, very remote. So I hope we can accelerate that. And once again, it's one of the things I think we should try to move again when we restart discussions, say December, January, after the German elections. That's for the banking union mostly. That was your last question.
Next step for the banking union. This may be probably the.
That's what we should do, I think. Yes.
Okay. The other question was more in the economic field. The idea of treasury, European treasury, mutualization of bonds.
I think what we should try to find out, because when we want to start a new domain, there is always the fear of certain countries that in the end what is asked to them is to sign checks. So we should try to avoid signing checks for the others, and it's always difficult to start like that. So my hope is that we can find ideas to foster the development of, even if it is very modest at the beginning, but the organization of an institutional framework with something precise to do that would be of common interest, for instance. And we had opportunities in the past to discuss that together, but if we were able to say, look, we're going to decide on a number of pan-European investment projects, which are infrastructures necessary to enhance the growth potential. And then for that, we need to we need to build up a fund or a system that will be able because it's long-term investments with a certain return, so it doesn't make sense to have only current budget money, but we could borrow and reimburse. We could start to build a system, and we will borrow together. So that's the euro bonds, but with the euro bonds, we will also make new investments in Germany as much as in France or in Spain. So I think the way everybody will look at that will be different, and we build something together with joint liabilities and with the hope of a return. It's not simply money for current expenditure, but it's money for the future, for investments, for our children, etc. If we are able to design something like that, then we can start to discuss about an institutional framework, probably Ministry of Finance. For me, one of the issues, once again, will be where do we do that? Is it the EU or is it the URIA? What do we want to enhance? And if only for the URIA members, having some sort of finance minister is acceptable, then we would need to have something on the parliamentary side. And I tend to think myself that perhaps the good concept would be a subset of the European Parliament for the URIA members to be able to vote on projects. There can be other concepts, but we need also to take on board this democratic participation in the form of probably the European Parliament or a subset of the European Parliament.
Okay, we're going to give the floor to the public. Una de las normas de la Fundación es que en este tipo de jornadas es dar la palabra al público, con lo cual...